I mentioned this morning how we are kind of getting into the meat of Revelation, and by that I mean the part that is very prophetic in nature. Revelation chapter 1, we're introduced to the main character in the book of Revelation, the Lamb, Jesus Christ, the first and the last, the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, and we see Him walking amongst the seven golden lampstands, the seven churches. And then, of course, in Revelation 2 and 3, we see those letters that Jesus writes to those congregations, those seven churches, describing His insight into those congregations and the areas that they were applauded for, praised for, and those areas in which they needed a great deal of work. Then, of course, chapters 4 and 5 introduce us to the subject of worship in heaven. Chapter 4 primarily showing the worship of God the Father in heaven, the 24 elders, the four living creatures around the throne, and them praising God the Father. Then chapter 5, the same thing, but focusing on Jesus Christ and Him being worthy of worship. Now, because He is worthy of that worship, He is the one able to open these seven seals that become the object of a great deal of concern for John, because he wants to know what's in the seals. And so do the Christians in the first century. They're the ones to whom the letter is primarily written, and it was to them, to those people, that had the most concern about it. They were the ones being persecuted. They were the ones that were having to give up their lives and property and so many things because they were being faithful to Christ. And so those are the ones to whom this book is addressed. And so John wants to know what is in the book, the scroll, and these seals. He wants to know what is in there. What does the future hold for the church? And so now in chapter 6, we start to see the unfolding and the answering of that question that was of such concern to the people there in the first century. Revelation chapter 6, notice how he begins in verse 1. Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, "Come and see." Here's where the main action of the book begins, really, Revelation chapter 6, verse 1. This is where the seals start to be opened. This is where the future of the church is foretold. And we see throughout this chapter and the following 15 chapters, all the way through Revelation chapter 20, who's in charge? And that's God. It's not the Roman Empire. It's not these priests. It's not some foreign power. It's not some church here or there. It is God. He's the one that is in charge, and He's the one that's in back of all of these things that are to happen. And of course, this book is apocalyptic, which means that it's an unveiling, it's a revealing. And you look at books in the Old Testament that are similar to this, like Ezekiel and Zechariah, and you look at this book and you certainly understand that apocalyptic literature is not interpreted like any other literature. You don't interpret it like you do Genesis or Exodus or Acts or Matthew. It's prophetic, it's apocalyptic, it's written, as John said in the very first chapter, this was going to be revealed by signs. And so it is this general idea of revealing that's important. Do all of the details have something to do with the future? Probably not. And of course, it's all of those things that so many in the religious world have taken to the extreme and come up with some of the wildest ideas imaginable. So what happens? The Lamb, Jesus Christ, is there and He opens one of the seals. He doesn't open them all at once. This book is sealed in a sense. Seven seals. He opens them one by one, or they are opened one by one. So it's a partial revealing, and then a little more revealed, and then a little more revealed, and then a little more revealed. That's certainly the idea behind the seals being opened one at a time. And it's the Lamb who's able to do that because He's the one that has the power. He's the one that's worthy. He's the one that has the qualifications to open it. And there's the four living creatures, and they're saying with a voice like thunder, come and see. There's something that John needs to see. And what is it that John needs to see? Well, there are four horses. Verse 2, and I looked, and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. It was a white horse. And of course, horses throughout the Bible, going back to the Old Testament days and all the way through to this time, horses were almost exclusively war animals, animals for battle. They were not used for, you know, like a beast of burden. They were not used for plowing and that type of thing. They were not farm-type animals. They were animals used for battle. And we certainly have the idea that there's some type of battle going on with these horses. And so a horse is pictured there, and it is a white horse, and the one that sat on it had a bow. And that person, a crown was given to him. And what did he do? He went out conquering and to conquer. That was his job. This crown right here, there are two crowns in the Bible talked about. They're both translated crown, but this is the crown that's Stephanos. This is the crown of a victor, someone who has won, not a crown of a king, but a crown of a victor, someone who is winning or someone who has won some type of race or battle. And usually this is the term used for someone who's went out into battle, conquered, and has came back and is crowned, is given a Stephanos to wear. He's the victor. So there is some type of war. There's some type of battle. And this one has a bow. I think there's two things that are important that would be important if I was living in the first century as a Christian. Number one, the Roman Empire had one physical enemy. And those were the Parthians. They lived east of the country of Rome. And they were a thorn in the flesh for the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire stretched throughout the world. They were never able to conquer their neighbor, the Parthians. Never able to. With their vast army, they were never able to conquer the Parthians. The Parthians were, number one, great horsemen, and number two, they were great with bows and arrows. Something the Roman Empire never learned how to do. They were never good horsemen, and they were never good at bows and arrows. And so the Parthians... So I'm a Christian in the first century, and I look at the Roman Empire. They continue to persecute me. But hey, there's somebody that's persecuting the Roman Empire. I feel better. The Roman Empire is not someone that can't be conquered. They have their own enemies. The enemies ride on horses, and number two, they shoot, or they use bows and arrows. I don't think that's his main point here. I think his main point has to do with the gospel. Because the one who sat on it is the one that's given the crown, and that seems to be an allusion to Jesus Christ Himself. And what is He doing? He's going out to conquer. But Jesus didn't fight physical battles. No, I don't think He's talking about a physical battle. I think He's talking about a spiritual one. Where the gospel is taken into the world. And what does the gospel do? It conquers people. Not physically. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, My servants would fight, but it's not of this world. My kingdom's not from here. My servants aren't going to ride on real horses with real bows and arrows, but My servants are going to go out into the world and they're going to conquer the world one person at a time, but they're going to conquer them in the sense of they're going to take the gospel to them. And it's a gospel that's going to go into all the world. And they're going to take it to the world, and they're going to be victorious. Why? Because Jesus was. What happens next? When He opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, remember, there were four living creatures that were around the throne of God. The second one says, come and see. There was something again. You know, come here. There's something for you to see. What is it? There's another horse. It's fiery red that went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth. And that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. Very interesting allusion here. A red horse. Usually red signifies bloodshed, war, battles. What was happening if Revelation was written somewhere in the last decade of the first century, which it seems to have been written in? What was happening to the Christians at that time? Of course, they were being terribly persecuted in so many ways. So much was happening to them. They were being persecuted. The Roman Empire was persecuting them. There was a great deal of bloodshed everywhere. They knew that. And maybe that's what he's alluding to here. The fact that there was going to be bloodshed. There was going to be persecution. Why? Why would there be persecution? Remember Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace into the world, but a sword. Mother-in-law be against father-in-law, or a daughter-in-law be against a mother-in-law. Mother-in-law against the daughter-in-law. There were going to be all kinds of persecutions for Christians. For those people who were going to be faithful, life, especially at that time, was not going to be easy. It was going to be very, very difficult for them in so many ways. And think about all the Christians that lost their lives, especially in those first two centuries, and really all the way into the first half of the third, because they were faithful to Christ. But what happens next? Because it comes right on the, you might say, the heels of the second. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third come and see. So I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. And of course, a pair of scales were used for weighing, weren't they? You still use a pair of scales today for weighing. But it's significant that what they're weighing out, the values were greatly different than they should be. A quart of wheat for a denarius, that is, we talked a little bit about that this morning, that was a day's wage for most people. I mean, you only got this much wheat for a whole day's wage? What does that usually signify when food is that high, that it's scarce? It's a famine. That seems to be what he's talking about. Or at least, food is not available as readily to Christians. Back when we looked at the letter to the church at Thyatira, we talked about the trade guilds in that particular city and how they were trying to force people to join these trade guilds. If you were a mason or a stonecutter, whatever, carpenter, they tried to force you into these trade guilds, and these trade guilds were idolatrous. When they met, they would sacrifice and so forth to these idols. And if you didn't belong to this trade guild, guess what? You didn't get jobs. You didn't get work. Christians couldn't join them because they were idolatrous. So here you have Christians that are basically being forced out. They couldn't get the good jobs. They couldn't get the good work. They couldn't get the good wages. So what? It's another way that they were being persecuted. So they would have to work all day long for just the food they could eat. So think about what we have so far. Jesus opening these seals. We see persecution of the Christians, which they were experiencing, they knew all about. How Christians were being both persecuted physically, they were being killed, some of them. Others were being forced out of good jobs, and they couldn't find work that would meet other than the most basic necessities. These people were experiencing those things in a major way, and so they were being discriminated against. Of course, I think there's a lesson for that. There's a lot of Christians today that are discriminated against, especially in other countries. I mean, there are in our country too, in a number of ways. But certainly there are in a lot of other countries today. They are discriminated against if you are a Christian. Sometimes you'll be fired from jobs. Sometimes you won't be able to get jobs if you're a Christian and they know you are. So this is what the Christians, many of them, that was the condition they found themselves in the first century. So they had to work all day at some menial job just to afford the most basic necessities, like the food, the barley, and the wheat. And when he says, and do not harm the oil and the wine, it seems to signify the fact that for other people, they were living quite well because oil and wine were luxuries. That's what people that had plenty of money, that's what they had, oil and wine. They were fine. But the Christians were barely getting by, at least many of them. Here comes the fourth horse. Verse 7, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come and see. So I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him, and power was given to them, or a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beast of the earth. So there's the fourth seal, and what do they see? That's a pale horse. The word pale there maybe is not translated like we would think, but it certainly signifies the color of someone who's dead. That's the idea. Someone who's dead. Because what? The name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him. Doesn't Hades always follow Death? Absolutely. Why? Because that's where the dead go, into Hades, into that realm of the unseen, that spirit world. That's where they go. So it's only natural that here's Death, and who's behind Death? Hades. And of course, we go to the end of the book of Revelation, and we see at the end of verse chapter 20, Death and Hades, what? Cast into the lake of fire. There's not going to be any more Death and no more Hades into Revelation chapter 20. They're both cast in there. But here we see Death and Hades together, and power was given to them, Death and Hades, over a fourth of the earth. Geographically a fourth of the earth? Just these countries here? Certainly not. And they were to do what? Well, they could kill with sword, with hunger, death, beast of the earth, all kinds of different ways that they were allowed to kill. This would indicate, if you look at those four seals together, you see Jesus on the first horse. Then you see the idea of Christians being persecuted in a number of ways, and physically, some of them being killed, some being discriminated against financially so that they were barely getting by. And then here, Death and Hades is allowed to go kill, destroy people on the earth. This seems to be at least a partial judgment on those people who are persecuting the Christians. And it could have came in a number of different ways, and there are lots of different ideas of how that happened, but that would seem to be the idea, is that because these Christians are being persecuted against, then God is bringing some retribution, some vengeance on those people. And of course, He did to the Roman Empire in a number of ways. If you read about what happened to the Roman Empire, especially in the 2nd and 3rd century, you'll see how God may have brought that about, that vengeance, that retribution against those people who were opposing the gospel, who were persecuting God's people. Remember in that great prophecy in Daniel chapter 2 where Nebuchadnezzar saw that great image, and we come down to that fourth empire which represented the Roman Empire. And what did it say? That, and in the days of these kings, the Roman kings, God would raise up a king, a very new kingdom. And what would happen to that kingdom? It would destroy, break in pieces, all those other kingdoms, including the Roman Empire. So I think that he's talking here about the fulfillment of Daniel chapter 2, the end of that great prophecy that is given to Daniel by God. So there we have those four that kind of, I think, all go together. The gospel, first seal, was preached. You know, it was taken all over the known world. Because of that, the Christians suffered a great deal of persecution, deadly persecution. They were discriminated against in a number of ways, but because of that, God was going to bring some retribution, some divine vengeance on that particular country anyway, who was bringing that persecution about. So I think those four seals and those four horses and four horsemen all go together. Certainly not talking about anything that's going to happen future of us. This was obviously something that happened a very long time ago. So what about the other seals? Verse 9, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held, and they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Well, then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. So here we see the martyrs under the altar. They had already been killed because they were faithful. Now, he had just mentioned about the rider on the horse. It was red. They were persecuted. They had been killed. Here are some of those people. They're pictured under the altar who had suffered that. They had been killed. They had been martyred. And so they're pictured as saying, how long before you take vengeance on the people who did that to us? Now notice, they were not wanting to do the vengeance themselves. They were simply asking God, when are you going to take retribution on those people who killed us? Good question. Valid question. When is that going to happen? Because they didn't know. Just because they had died, they weren't given miraculous information about future events. They still didn't have any idea. So they're pictured as asking God, when is that going to happen? When are you going to take vengeance on those people who killed us? And they're given white robes. Certainly the idea of some a victory because of what they had done. They're wanting to know what's going to happen to everybody else. He said, well, just rest a little while longer. Not much longer, a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed. God's saying there's some more people that's going to be martyred before it's done. There's going to be some more people who are going to be martyred. Was completed. And it was completed. That's not something that's going to happen in the future. That's something that happened long time ago. They were saying, when is this going to happen? Now, I know he's not talking about the end of time, and you know why? There's still some seals left to go. That's only the fifth one. And then when we get to the sixth seal, and then the seventh seal, and then in the seventh seal, there's seven bowls of wrath, and then after that, there's seven judgments. So there's a lot happens after the fifth seal. So I know that's not the end of time. Couldn't be. Wouldn't fit with anything else in the Bible or anything else in this book. So at that time, for those people, there were still some left to be martyred. They didn't know how many. We don't know how many. But whatever that number was, when it was completed, then he said he would take vengeance. So wait. Rome's time would come. There would come a time when that Roman Empire, their persecutors, would be brought down. And of course it was. It was brought down. It just wasn't going to happen immediately. Said, you just wait a little bit longer, and then I will take them down. I'll bring judgment on them. That was the fifth seal. Notice the sixth. I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth, as a fig tree drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? This is quite a picture here, this sixth seal. Now, he had just, if we kind of take this in order, He had just told them in the fifth seal, the martyrs under the altar who's crying out for vengeance, he said, wait a little while longer and I'll do it. And what's the sixth seal? He said, this is what I'm going to do. So this vengeance is pictured as a great earthquake, a great storm. What's the other terms he uses? Sun becoming black, the moon becoming blood, stars of heaven falling to the earth. So this vengeance, this retribution by God upon those persecutors is pictured like this. Not probably as a literal earthquake. The sun didn't turn black. Moon didn't become like blood. Stars didn't all fall to the earth. I know that because all the stars are bigger than the earth. So if stars would have actually fell out of heaven and hit the earth, there wouldn't be any earth anymore. So I know that's not what he's talking about. Not talking about physical things. Again, this is apocalyptic literature. This is symbolic. This is given to us in signs. But this is a great judgment. This is a great vengeance. It says a great earthquake. And the stars of heaven fell to the earth. And it was like a fig tree dropping its late figs. Lots of stars falling from heaven. You go back to the Old Testament, this is a very typical symbol or figure for leaders and countries falling. Stars falling from heaven is a typical way that the Holy Spirit used, especially in the Old Testament, to describe countries and people falling from power. They're pictured as stars falling from heaven. So here, those people who are persecuting God's people are going to fall. And of course they did. And it wasn't all that long in the future when they started to fall. So this heavy judgment, if you want to call it this, great judgment, is seen here. It's not the second coming of Christ. It's not the end of the world. It is talking about what happened to that Roman Empire, those pagan people. And that country was going to come down. And the Bible said it would never rise again. And of course it hasn't. Is there a Roman Empire today? Definitely not. Nor will there ever be again. God destroyed it. And of course he did that through Christ, but it was destroyed. Why? Well, one of the main reasons was that empire persecuted, killed God's people. And so God took retribution, divine vengeance on them. The people didn't do that themselves. You know, the Bible says, don't avenge yourselves, but let God do it. You know, it's God's vengeance. We're not to take vengeance ourselves. God can if he so desires, but we're not supposed to. So the people in the first century, they didn't take vengeance, but God did. He took retribution on those people. And they're pictured that way. So this judgment was on those people. And they were, they're pictured, all the kings of the earth, great men, rich men, mighty men. It's like they're trying to hide from God, hide in the caves and the rocks of the mountains. And they're saying, fall on us, hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne. Who is that? Well, we already pictured that in Revelation chapter 4. It's God the Father. Hide us from him. And hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. Hide us from Christ. So the Father and the Son are pictured together as being the ones bringing vengeance and retribution on these people. Would they be able to hide in caves? Nope, because God knows exactly where those caves are. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Nobody. Now just think, this was written to those people in the first century. Think about how comforting this chapter would be if you had lost a brother or a sister because the Roman Empire, some of those people, that imperial cult, they had came and killed them. Think about how this part of the letter would be comforting to you. Because those persecutors that killed your brother, or your sister, your mom or dad, daughter, or whoever, God says, I'm going to take vengeance on them, and it's going to be ugly. It's going to be a terrible vengeance. And I'll bring them down, just like he predicted, Daniel chapter 2. My kingdom will destroy that kingdom, and that kingdom will never rise again. So those people in the first century, they could take comfort in the fact that this persecution was only going to be for a little while. Even if that little while was 200 years, it was a little while. And that Roman Empire would no longer exist. It would be done, it would be broken, crumbled, dust, and it would never rise again. That would be comforting to me if I lived in the first century as a Christian and saw all that persecution. And remember, that's why the book is written. Especially chapter 6 through 20. 21 and 22 is written pretty much for everybody of all time. But chapter 6 through 20 really focuses on those people in the first century who were being so severely persecuted. So when we look at this book, as I mentioned the first night, through first century glasses, we really understand the hope, the encouragement, the consolation, the admonition that would come to somebody in the first century who had experienced that persecution. Will the world ever see that again? I have no idea. But they saw it then, and they experienced it. And the same thing they were told, be faithful even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life, that same thing holds today. Be faithful in all areas of your life. Be faithful. And that's sometimes hard in our world because we are discriminated against in some ways. That might get worse, it might get better, I don't have any idea, but we are discriminated against by being faithful followers of Christ. So regardless of your station in life, you may experience that for whatever reason. And when that happens, you can identify with those people in the first century. How did they make it? It's easy. They assembled together. Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, as is the manner of some. Don't do that. That was probably written about 20 years or so before Revelation was written. The writer was getting the people ready for what was going to happen in a few years. Be ready. Don't forsake the assembly. Those people were glad to be with each other because those were the people that gave them strength. They didn't get it from the world. They got it from each other. And so do we. So when we sing this invitation song in a minute, let's think about our relationship with Christ. Do we have one? Have we experienced that new birth? Or number two, do we need to ask for strength? And if either one of those is something you need, I encourage you to come forward as we stand and sing this song.